The House Committee on Capital Investment will come to order. The Committee Legislative Assistant will note the roll, and a quorum is present. I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Juergens, have you approved the minutes of yesterday's meeting? Oh, that's right. It wasn't yesterday. Of January 30th's meeting.
I have, and I move the minutes.
All right. Any discussion? Hearing none?
Some of us were here for yesterday's meeting.
Do you have the minutes?
No, but we do have a picture to prove it.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passed. Okay. And speaking of the meeting yesterday, I'm sorry that there was a little misunderstanding and some people didn't get the notice that we weren't meeting yesterday.
And by the way, there are people from both caucuses that showed up.
Well, we are bipartisan.
Yeah, of course. But there were more Democrats
present. I won't make any comments about that. I guess particularly at this time of the session, things are a little more, less definite as to when we're meeting. We'll try to make sure that everyone knows.
And I was trying not to be critical.
I just
wanted you to know if possible we could put that picture in as a part of the record, however, so that there was, in fact, a meeting yesterday.
We'll vote on that later. One other thing I did want to note before we get going today, and that is that our committee researcher here, Brian Rosenblatt, is his last day with us. And thank you for your service and the work that you've done over the years. We could maybe squeeze you in on the bus if you just want to come with for fun next summer, but let us know. But thank you. Okay, today, after we have approved the minutes now, what I'm going to do is bring House File 575 before the committee. It's not in the folder, so we're going to do Jeff Freeman first. Mr. Freeman, from the Public Facilities Authority, would you care to give us your report, please? And then after this, we have a couple of bills that we need to consider.
Okay.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. I believe in your packets you have a set of our handouts that I'll be going through some fairly quickly, but happy to stop at any point and answer questions. First of all, just kind of an overview. The Public Facilities Authority is a multi-agency authority. Really, our primary mission is to help cities finance water infrastructure projects, primarily wastewater and drinking water, some storm water as well. Our agency is governed by a board of six state commissioners that you can see listed on the handout. The commissioner of Deed, Employment and Economic Development, is the chair of the PFA board. Essentially, the PFA is an infrastructure bank or a bond bank. We manage investments and transactions of three revolving loan funds, also administer a number of different grant programs. Our member agencies are, and we, all of the programs that we administer are done in conjunction with one or more of our member agencies. They are responsible for setting project priorities, doing technical reviews of the projects. PFA staff do the credit review of the city's finances and the enterprise fund. Award the loans, service the loans, coordinate funding among all different programs that we administer as well as other funding agencies, and help cities kind of navigate the whole process. We receive our largest funds are the Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Loan Funds. We receive federal and state dollars for those, to support those. We're also authorized to sell PFA revenue bonds up to $1.5 billion. PFA bonds are not backed by the state. They're solely backed by the loans, the loan repayments that we've made and the investment earnings of the funds. They're rated AAA by all three rating agencies. Current bonds outstanding about $974 million, and we have about $2.4 billion in assets. The revolving loan funds with the federal and state dollars, federal capitalization grants, there's a state match requirement, and then all of the loan repayments under federal and state law revolve back to support new loans. So these become permanent sources of low-interest capital to help cities finance their water infrastructure needs. Currently, the Clean Water Revolving Fund has an average annual lending capacity of about $94 million per year, drinking water about $39 million. PFA receives no state general fund dollars for administration. All of our admin funds are paid through financing fees and a small amount of set aside from the federal dollars that we get. We're a very small agency. We have 10 staff. Some support functions we contract with the Department of Employment and Economic Development for. And then we also, through interagency agreements, pay for staff at the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department, mostly engineers and people involved in the technical project reviews. On the back side, or the second page, you can kind of see an org chart that sort of visually illustrates all the different departments and how we work with each on the various programs and funds. The next page then gets into our governor's bonding recommendations for the PFA this year, a total of $167 million. The first, and you probably are aware that number has been talked about a lot over the last couple of years. Minnesota has an estimated approximately $11 billion in water infrastructure needs of communities over the next 20 years. The governor's bonding proposal is really a comprehensive first step at really addressing those needs in a systematic and comprehensive way. The first item is $25 million for the state match to the federal capitalization grants. This is, again, our largest financing programs, these two Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Loan Funds. There's a strong leveraging of the state dollars in these programs. Each to date over the history of the programs, $1 that we've received has generated over $14 of project construction and over $3 of interest savings to the local communities and their taxpayers, because all the loans we make are at below market interest rates. The requested funds will provide the required 20% match for expected 2017 and 18 federal dollars, and in addition help provide some additional capital to help build the lending capacity of the funds to meet increased demand. Currently, the lending capacity of these funds, as I mentioned, $94 million and $39 million. That's less than a third of the 2017 requests that we've received. So the demands are significant, and these funds become a major part of the state's assistance to cities to help meet those needs. The second item of the governor's bonding request is the WIF program, which is the Wastewater Infrastructure Fund. It's been around for quite a while. legislators I know are pretty familiar with it. These are the grants that are based on affordability criteria that are packaged with our loans, or in some cases matched with USDA rural development financing, primarily focused on smaller communities that have the greatest financial hardship. The governor's recommendation this year includes a major change to expand that program to also include drinking water infrastructure projects, again based on affordability criteria. The total request is $80 million. Right now the grant cap is $4 million. The governor recommends increasing that to $5 million. Finally, the third item, the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, the recommendation there is $62 million. These grants help cities upgrade treatment plants to meet or reduce specific discharge of specific pollutants to meet water quality goals set by the Pollution Control Agency. This program has been funded at lower levels in past years through Clean Water Legacy Funds. The governor's proposal is to supplement the Clean Water Fund dollars with bonding and to significantly increase the grant percentages and maximum grants from the current 50% to 80% grants, and the current cap of $3 million to increase that to $7 million per project. The next page, before we get into the lists and how that works, I wanted to offer this bar chart that kind of illustrates the leveraging that we're able to get from the revolving loan funds. The bar chart shows over the past 10 years or so, in the green bars, the financing that we've provided to cities through the Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Funds. The blue columns are the federal dollars. The red are the state dollars that have been appropriated each year. You can see that because of the loan repayments that have been building and continuing, actually in the case of the Clean Water Fund goes back to 1990, all those repayments have created a lot of strength to continue to make these loans on an ongoing basis. The federal and state dollars support those loans and allow us to do the below market interest rates. Currently, most of our loans are at about 1.5%. Then the next page, the green sheets. And if you've been around, you know I never go anywhere without my green and blue spreadsheets. So the green sheets are the clean water project priority list. The priorities are set based on environmental and public health criteria by the Pollution Control Agency. Projects are ranked 1 through 300 and something. This is a five-year list. So cities with projects on this list, some are just in the early planning stages and others are ready to go to construction right now. We don't fund a project until they actually are ready to start construction. This is a list that's done every year. A lot of projects carry over, obviously, from one year to the next. The projects with the gray rows all the way across are projects that we have funded this year since July. You can see that the total project cost here, which I think is about $1.5 billion in total, and then the next column over it says CWRF loan 2017 IUP requested loans. These are the projects with dollar amounts in that column have requested loans for construction projects in 2017. There's also some of the federal money we can use as grants, a small little sliver. That's the principal forgiveness grant column. You also see a column for WIF. you see with what we've awarded and reserved to date, as well as the estimated needs under the governor's recommendation for the higher grants and the program, the based on the affordability criteria. There's also a column for the point source implementation grants, which show both what cities would get under the current program, as I said, 50% up to $3 million, as well as the increased levels that the governor has recommended. You see there's also a small community program that we run, and then you can see on the, to the far right the other funders, some of the other funders that we work with and coordinate with, primarily USDA Rural Development, who also run loan and grant programs in a similar fashion. We coordinate with them, determine which program works the best for particular projects, and in some cases use our WIF state WIF grant funds to match with their dollars. After the green sheets, there is an alphabetical listing if you're trying to find a particular city, and of course I'm always willing, if there's particular cities that you're concerned about that you've heard have projects that they're looking for financing, I'm happy to meet with any of you to go over in more detail particular projects. The blue sheets...
Yeah, Mr. Freeman, how far down the list does $167 million get you?
We have historically, over the past several years, the green sheets, the wastewater list, we've been able to fund down to 45 points. So any project 45 points and above that has a construction project ready to go, we can at least offer the loan funds to them. The grants, you know, we try to hopefully have the grants and the loans sort of balance, but typically we run out of the grant funds much earlier as we come down the priority list. The loan funds can go further. With the projected increase in grant funds proposed by the governor, that's also going to put more pressure on the loans. The grants are kind of the limiting factor. A lot of these cities that are higher ranked just can't afford to do their project with the loan funds by themselves. So they're waiting to try to get some grant money, and then when grant funds are available, they're able to we're able to package in with the loans and fund those projects. So they kind of go hand in hand.
What is the, Mr. Freeman, the last several bonding years, not counting last year, what is the average bonding amount that you received? Just a ballpark.
Mr. Chair, it does kind of bounce around and up and down, I believe, in... for reference, 2014, we received $18.3 million in the 2014 bonding bill, and then there was a small bonding bill again in 2015, and we received another $10 million. So over that two-year period, $28 million, and all of those funds are now committed to projects, most of which are under construction right now or ready to start this spring.
Well, it seemed to me over the years that it was about $30 million. Roughly.
Mr. Chair, we've never been as high as 30, but usually right around 20 or sometimes a little higher.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is if you're reaching 45 on previous bills, with this bill, if it were significantly higher, like $140 million, $160 million, wouldn't you be a lot farther down the list?
Mr. Chair, I hope we can get somewhat further down the list, but as I said, with additional grant funds, it means that some of these higher-ranked projects that have been there for years and haven't been able to proceed now hopefully will be able to proceed, which means for a given point value of 45 points, there's a lot more fundable projects within that range. And so it's something we look at each year, demand and requests compared to the funding available. That cutoff point is set each year. I'm hopeful we can maintain it at that 45 point level, and hope and maybe even stretch it a little further. There's a lot of good projects below 45 points that I would like to get to, but we'll have to see how it goes.
Okay, Representative Hausman, do you have a question?
Yeah, to that point, so just to follow up on that, what I seem to recall in years past when we would inquire about a particular town and why it wasn't moving forward, you reminded us it's because perhaps that local government hasn't done the certain required steps. And so my question was, just given your time, your staff time, and some of these projects where the local government hasn't yet done their work, do you have any sort of ballpark figure in this next year how much work you could actually get done to the point of approving a project? Because I know there are time constraints in your department and there are obligations that local governments haven't yet done. So, I mean, just to the chair's initial question, if we put this much in, would you get through this many projects? You can't really guarantee that because you don't know if the local governments will be ready, and if you're working with the same staff you always have, how that would happen.
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, you are correct. There's a lot of sort of factors in there that affect how quickly projects can move, and a lot of it is at the local level. A lot of it beyond our own staff resources is the consulting engineers and the contractors that build these projects, and the capacity there goes up and down, but of course it's also affected by other construction projects that are going on at the time. So it's hard to say for sure. Certainly with the fee revenues that we generate, we do have some ability to hire additional staff if needed. Pollution Control Agency did receive some supplemental funding last year based on the they haven't started spending it yet, but it was based on the knowledge that the proposed increased funding will generate a lot of additional projects. And so, we have sort of tried to put some things in place and are prepared to respond as much as we can, because what we really try to do as much as possible is we want, when the city is ready to do their project, I want the cities to set their schedule and to communicate that with us, and to the maximum extent we can, when the city is ready to do their project, we'll have the funding there for them and able to process the funding and get those projects done. That's our goal. We've been pretty successful at doing that within a fundable range, and this certainly is a ramp up of funding, and which will lead to a ramp up of projects. We'll hopefully be able to respond to that.
Well, maybe I'll just follow up one more, because the first question you asked, if we put this much in, you'll get down to X number. So you can say all the projects down to that number, they're all ready to go. All you have to do is arrange the grant. That's what I'm trying to get a clearer sense of.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the cities, a lot of them are actually what you would call shovel ready to go. Others, other projects have completed the planning work. The cities have not fully invested in the next step, the design work, the plans and specs to have a construction ready project. It's sort of they're hopeful that this funding will be there, and they're certainly ready to move, hoping that it is, but it's sort of a chicken and egg kind of question. I would like to point out, in response kind of to the question, it's hard to see from these big sheets sort of the timing element of these particular programs. So I have added something new to our packet this year. The last three sheets after the drinking water alphabetical, there are three white sheets. There is a sheet for the WIF program for wastewater projects, one for the WIF program for drinking water, and one for that point source implementation grant program. These are the last three sheets in your packet. Starting with the wastewater one, if I can, this shows projects on the current priority list that have an identified need for the WIF grants, both the projects that have already been approved for 2016. These are literally, as I said, shovel-ready projects. Plans and specs are approved. They're ready to bid. As well as 2017 projects that are in line for 2017, meaning they've got the planning work done. In some cases, they have started the design, plan and spec work, but these are projects lined up and ready, planning to be ready to go for 2017. You can see the estimated grant needs, both those to match with our loans as well as to match with USDA Rural Development. You can see over the next 2 years, the governor has recommended of the $80 million for the WIF program. He's recommended a split of $55 million on the wastewater side, $25 million on the drinking water side. You can see this 2016 projects in 2017 is a little over $51 million, which means if the governor's request was approved, we'd have a little bit to carry forward into 2018. We'd be able to fund all of these projects and a little for 2018. The next sheet shows that same wastewater infrastructure funding program. Again, this is now based on the governor's recommendation to expand that program to include drinking water, which would be brand new. We haven't used these funds for that for drinking water projects before, but the needs are certainly there. And this sheet, again, shows projects that have been approved and certified from 2016, ready to go, as well as 2017 that are lined up and can be ready quickly. The governor recommended then $25 million, the split for the drinking water. And then finally, if I can, the last sheet shows projects that are eligible for that point source implementation grant program. Again, these are the projects to upgrade treatment facilities to meet the more stringent limits. A lot of times it's phosphorus. There's some chloride issues. In particular, the city of Morris, who's here today, has a project on the list to address chloride. City of Detroit Lakes is here with a major project to address phosphorus. You can see on this list, again, projects that were certified in 2016 and projects that are lined up for 2017. You can see the different amounts between the current program and the governor's recommendation. In a few cases, on the 2016 projects, cities basically were hoping for a bonding bill last year when it wasn't approved. Some of these cities just couldn't wait. And so we funded them under the current program. We gave them additional loan dollars so that, because we always, when we fund a project, it's full project funding. We did give them additional loan dollars, but we've structured it in such a way that if there is a bonding bill approved this year, we are going to try to go back and do some amendments to give them additional grant dollars. You can see that the projects that are highlighted in gray fall into that situation. So these lists, and again, this is just sort of pulling out a subsets of the green and the blue sheets. You can see the rank numbers match up to the larger spreadsheets, but this kind of helps to see more clearly what projects are eligible for these particular programs and the timing that they can do.
Thank you. I think what we'll do, Mr. Freeman, is take a brief, no, I should say recess. We're going to take up those two bills and then come back to you for questions. Thank you. So, since you now have the bills before you, I would like to bring House File 575 before the committee. And I will move that House 575 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. These are, if you haven't figured it out already, vehicle bills. We're just trying to, be ready to have these if needed. And obviously we took 575 because the tax chair told me it was the most important bill in the bonding bill anyway.
Mr. Chair, it might actually be the second. I think the Chatfield Center for the Arts might be the first.
Well, they're kind of tied, I think. But, so, there are no questions on this. I will renew my motion that House File 575 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? There goes one down the road. Next is 576. I would like to bring House File 576 before the committee, and I move that House File 576 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Once again, this is a vehicle bill. Is there any discussion here? Notice it's a HEPA bill, and the appropriation line is blank. Any other discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill prevails. And now we can go back to PFA.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rowley.
Mr. Chair, as you're coming forward, I just want to just express my support for Lanesboro Dam. I believe they had the best pastries and treats on the, I think it's pretty accurate memory. So.
Well, thank you, Representative Rowley, and certainly the support of a capital investment committee cannot be bought off by food. However, it was good at Lanesboro, I will admit. Are there any questions of Mr. Freeman? I will say there are a couple of testifiers here as well. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Freeman, I was listening, but I'm not sure you mentioned per capita. Do you have a breakdown of public investment per capita for these communities that they're receiving?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have anything prepared, a breakdown of per capita. Certainly the project costs per capita are greater, much greater for small communities. There's no doubt that smaller communities have fewer users to spread the costs over and have a much more difficult financial challenge to maintain the infrastructure.
Representative Hansen?
And so, knowing a number of small communities and having a couple of small communities in my district, so is there a threshold where they're too small, where they're not going to receive the money because they're no longer viable?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we do not have a specific threshold at which they're too small or are not viable. We and we recognize that, well, as we're doing financial reviews of all our projects, we are looking carefully at making sure they set the rates, you know, in order to operate and maintain the system and pay back the debt, whether it's our debt for the new project or sometimes existing debt for that they've already previously incurred elsewhere. That can often get quite expensive. The WIF grants help, but typically it's still very expensive, even with a WIF grant. The point source grants can help some, but the basic replacement of aging infrastructure that, you know, once a city has a drinking water system or a wastewater system, they're in the business forever. There's no way to sort of back out of that, at least not that I can quite comprehend how it would be done. So it becomes difficult, there's no doubt, for small communities to maintain that infrastructure. That's why the WIF grants are so critical. We do not set a particular threshold, but we certainly make sure the city fully understands what the costs are and sets the rates accordingly. In some cases, that's why cities have been on the list for a long time and haven't been able to move forward, because they have a hard time making the local decision to raise those rates to a point that they can afford to do the project.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, with changing populations and we're all getting older and maybe the homes get older and the value of those homes is less. Let's just say hypothetically there's a town of 40 people and they have a system that's a legacy system that can't be maintained, and the question is, do you put $2 or $3 million into that, or do you find an alternative way of, you know, maybe putting them back into a different system, or they're absorbed into a township or something? These are very uncomfortable conversations to have, but I think they're real. And it's 2017, and I'll be very clear. I have a town of 150 people in the middle of the metro area. So these are things, whether you're in a metro county or a suburban county or a rural county, the public cost. And if we're going to break the seal, which I think we are, of doing nitrate removal for drinking water, that is a whole nother world of cost that's coming up here. And so the long-term costs are huge here. And is it fair? Is it fair if those costs are provided by somebody else, and then some places don't get any help for those costs? Is that fair? So I think this is a conversation we should have. We like giving money to the Public Facilities Authority. I voted for that. You guys do good work. But our state is changing rapidly, as are other states, and it might be good to see if there are some way of dealing with this where there might be alternative methods of different ways of providing the service and governance if communities wanted to.
Hey, Representative Hanson, I think you touch upon a very interesting concept. I'd like you to come out to the city of Darwin and talk to them about it. Sure, all 200 people would be real excited to hear that. But no, let me, more seriously, Representative Hanson, say that, you know, of course, you know, the tax base isn't there in rural Minnesota that there is in the metro area. We just don't have the tax base, and I cannot emphasize enough how important as I'm sure you know, this PFA money currently is to Greater Minnesota. This is where the wastewater treatment plants come from. This is where the water towers come from. And without assistance from the state, there are large parts of Minnesota where I don't know that people could afford to live. The cost of the new facilities would be so great, the cost of the property taxes would be so great that they couldn't live there. And when we talk about how it influences per capita, it's more than just the place where the wastewater treatment plant is established. Now, I've had in my county, Cosmos is in the western edge, and you got Dassel in the eastern edge. I've had people in Dassel say to me, you know, well, why should we put Cosmos in a bonding bill? Why should we have to pay for what's going on in Cosmos? Well, that's because the watershed goes from west to east, and eventually it's coming to Dassel. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have to think of it a little more globally, I think, than just how that plant affects those people in a particular town. But now you can reply, Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, and I think you know, and Representative Gunter knows this, that town where I went to school is 300 people. There were 26 people in my graduating class. That school is empty and abandoned right now. There are towns around that are 50 or 25 people.
Was repurposed once.
And Representative Hansen, you know, it's not just, you know, the wastewater, but you can look at education, you can look at health care, and all of these other things that are in some ways impacted the same way.
And I think that's my point, Mr. Chair, is that there are a number of us around the table who don't get that assistance, where we may have constituents who are asked to pay very high fees to cover it, where they don't have the tax capacity. But, and I'll just go right to the governor's bonding. You have $100+ million for PFA, but you've got, I think, $2.5 or $3 million for inflow infiltration. So if I have a constituent who has to pay $8,000 on their 1938 home and they're 85 years old and they're on Social Security, are they different than the person who's going to be getting the assistance? I think they're all Minnesotans. And I think we can figure a way out of doing this instead of just doing what we always do, which is let's open up the spigot and figure out how, and give people money. There could be alternative ways of doing this if we find different ways of treatment or different ways of using the money. But we have dramatic changes going on in our state with where people come and where people go and where they move and how they pay. And I think that's a conversation we have to have. It's not being critical of where people live, but we have to look at where we're at and where we're going to go and figure out how to do this. Because I look at this and there's great people living in all these towns. There's great people living in all of our districts. But there needs to be a fairness as well in terms of making sure things work.
And you raise a lot of good points, Representative Hansen. I certainly agree with you in the concept that we are all Minnesotans and need to keep that in mind through all. And you know, maybe in the future, you know, some of the thoughts you bring up, should have more consideration. If you can come up with a plan that you think is a nice, fair plan, you know, next year's bonding bill, maybe we can take a look. But, this is where we are today. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've actually had this conversation on the bus a time or two when we have been touring, and it usually occurs when we are in a town, and I won't name the one we were in, where we're told, many of these towns no longer have a grocery store or a doctor's office. In this one town, their only employer was the nursing home, the long-term care facility, and so you sort of see where that town is going. And what I hear Representative Hansen saying is not that we don't do anything, but do we stay with the same technology that we have funded, which is a pretty expensive technology, or do we ask questions, are there other ways, are there other technologies out there, a different direction? That's what I heard you saying, and that conversation we've actually had on the bus. What is the state of the art for a town in that situation? Are there other options? And I don't know if we've ever asked you specifically. So you're not on the bus. but that is a question that we have sometimes wondered about. Is there a different way of accomplishing the same thing?
Yeah, you know, Representative Hansen, I don't mean to, you know, denigrate anything that you're saying. These are things that maybe do need to be looked at, but not going to happen in the next couple of weeks. Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's probably over several years that this conversation is going to occur, but it needs to occur. And I think we refer to the bus, but, you know, the beauty of this is the cameras are on, the people are here. It's not a conversation on the bus. It's a conversation in public. And it's a conversation we need to engage in public, and it's not a two-week conversation. It's months and years on this, and because the obligations are going to grow quickly, particularly on drinking water, over the next months and years.
Thank you. The conversation can continue for a long time. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, I see there's a community of mine on here in Port, Minnesota. They're 1/8, 64th, and I see the project cost estimated, but behind that, through the funding, none of the vehicles are checked or no appropriations are committed. Is this because they are not far enough along in their project, so nothing specific has been taken or appropriated? That's my question.
Freeman? Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, that's exactly right. There's, as I said, this is a projected five-year list of projects. So there are a lot of projects that are still sort of in the planning stages or haven't yet committed to a time schedule to actually build their project, at which point we start lining them up under the different programs. We have actually had conversations with the City of Newport. I know they've done some work on their own, financed on their own, and they're looking at continuing. This is a replacing old sewer pipes, including some, looking at how to replace some service connections that are letting in a lot of clear water, I&I as it's called, into the system, and then the city has to pay for the treatment of that, and that's an issue for a lot of cities, and I think the City of Newport is still sort of sorting through how they want to do this and haven't gotten yet to the point of applying for funding.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Freeman.
Thank you. Representative Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm new to the committee. Do we not ever have central regional water treatment, wastewater treatment plans for several communities?
Representative Constantine, I'm aware of at least one. I'm sure there are probably many in the state, but Annandale, Howard Lake, and Maple Lake have joined together with one wastewater treatment plant.
Developed a sewer district.
Okay. Well, we've got one plant, one sewer district, yes. So there's one, there are probably more.
Well, Mankato now does Eagle Lake, Skyline, North Mankato, Lake Washington. They've just been adding them one at a time.
Okay. Representative Sock?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious about something. This could be just my naivety. On the very back sheet where it's talking about little individual projects, I noticed that the reason for your involvement, and there's various things listed there, causative probably triggers. I'm curious, is there any weighting done as to order or urgency relative to reason? Because some of these reasons, in my world, would move them to number one on any and every list that could ever be generated, like untreated sewage.
Mr. Freeman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, certainly the ranking criteria that are used by the Pollution Control Agency for these projects is heavily weighted toward public health and environmental factors. And so the ranking numbers that you see do take that into account. The unsewered type communities, which is where you see the fecal notation, those certainly, when there are failing septics and raw sewage directly into a surface water or a ditch or something, those rank very high. They're also sort of ranked based on numbers and density, because these programs are focused on community systems. So individual septic systems that might have a problem but are dispersed aren't ranked here, but if it's a small community with a high density that has that issue, that tends to rank them higher. So those factors are taken into account.
Okay, thank you. I think at this time, Mr. Freeman, you could step down. We will have a couple of testifiers come forward. We have Blaine Hill, the Morris City Manager, and Brunel Roberts, the Director of Detroit Lakes Public Utilities. If you please come forward. And I'd like to thank the members for the discussion that we just had. I think that it's an important one that we'll need to address more deeply as we go into the future. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Identify yourself, please.
My name is Blaine Hill. I'm the city manager for the city of Morris. You want me to go ahead?
Might as well, then we'll go to Detroit Lakes next.
Right. Mr. Chair, thank you, committee, for having me here. The reason I'm here is I'm going to talk about the Morris project. It's a water treatment plant. We have a water treatment plant. It's up and running, and we didn't have any plans to replace it. But we also have a chloride problem in the city of Morris because the water softeners and the salt that goes into the sewer goes into our sewage system and ultimately gets into the Pamunkey River. So we have a mandate from the MPCA to meet our chloride limit that was set by 2020. We were here last year in the legislature, and we came pretty close to getting a bonding bill that would provide some additional funding for us, and we could have started a water treatment plant, and we could have had it built and up and running in 2018. So the question is, why are we building a water treatment plant if we have a chloride problem going into the sewer? Because you cannot correct chloride at a wastewater plant. You can't do it. The cost of doing that would be astronomical. So the general consensus, and I'm actually sitting on a chloride working group with MPCA, the general consensus is that you have to do it at the beginning. We have some of the hardest water in the state of Minnesota, and in order to use it in our residential areas, our businesses, our institutions, you have to soften it. So our plan is to soften it at the water plant. The cost of that new plant is $18.5 million. We actually bid it last year. And maybe just to answer two of the questions that were raised, Representative Hausman, in order for us to get to the point where it's shovel-ready, we had to invest $800,000 in money to design the water treatment plant to be able to have it shovel-ready and to bid out. And we actually bid it out. And one of the other points I'd like to make is that we're actually servicing the city of Alberta, Minnesota, which is about 6 miles away from us because they can no longer do their own water treatment. In our bid, we had a contingent upon getting additional funding from the state of Minnesota. It didn't happen. We could have started building right after the legislative session was done. We had to let that bid go. We tweaked the bid specs a little bit, and we're getting ready to open a new bid on March 9th to see what that looks like. Obviously, costs have probably gone up. So we're thinking that we're probably going to be in about the same range as we were before. If we could get started this year, we could probably have the plant up and running by 2019 and meet the deadline. If we can't get started this year and we have to wait another year, then we're probably going to be pretty close to meeting that deadline for having the chloride coming out of the system. So we're here to ask you to consider helping communities that wind up spending additional funds to be able to meet mandates like this chloride mandate when we're already taking care of the normal business that we would have taken care of. In our case, in order to build this plant ourselves, to do this, tear down a plant that we're already using, we're looking at probably doubling the rates for water on our businesses, on our institutions, and on our homes, and there's a lot of concern for that. Can I answer any questions if you have?
Mr. Hill, thank you. I think we'll do. Let's go to Mr. Roberts and make your presentation, please, and then we'll have questions for both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vernell Roberts, General Manager, Detroit Lakes Public Utilities in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. I'm here to talk about our project, and our project was driven by regulatory changes, specifically our permitted phosphorus discharge limit. Years ago, and currently we're operating under 1 milligram per liter phosphorus limit, which is a pretty low limit in Minnesota. And that was changed to a 0.066 milligrams per liter. We got hit with a 94% reduction in our permitted levels. And that's steep. That 0.066 is the lowest and one of the lowest in Minnesota and the upper Midwest for permitted discharge levels. The MPC also put us into a compliance schedule. So during that compliance schedule, they are required to do a facility plan, system design, construction, and that plan goes for 10 years. The compliance schedule runs out for 10 years. We need to be in compliance by October of 2022. At the present moment, we are 2 weeks away from reviewing the 90% design of our facility. Our plan is to have 100% design completed by March. The plans sent to the MPCA for their review, approval by the Public Utilities Commission in Detroit Lakes and the Detroit Lakes City Council to advertise for bids in June. Send those bids to the MPCA and the PFA for approval, providing they get funding this year. And award a contract in late July or early August and get a shovel in the ground this fall. We need to do that because the construction project will last approximately 2 years and we need to meet our compliance schedule. $15 million of our $36 million facility is directly attributable to phosphorus reduction. So the reduction and the permitted reduction is driving the cost of our facility. PFA funding for us is critical. PFA funding, the PFA has some guidelines for what they call the affordability. The affordability for water and wastewater is 1.4% of the median household income in your community. Median household income in Detroit Lakes is $39,762. That means our average residential sanitary sewer bill should be about $46. Borrowing $36 million and funding that without PFA assistance, our bills would be almost $100 for an average residential household. With PFA loans and no grant availability, that will go to $81.35. And if the PFA is funded, according to the governor's request, our average residential bill will be down to $68. And that's still above the affordability threshold, but it's certainly a lot more palatable than $80 to $100 utility bill. 17% of our population in Detroit Lakes lives below the poverty level. So it's a significant impact to the citizens of our community. You remember in the governor's address a little over a week ago, we talked about Malt Works, a business coming to Detroit Lakes that's going to be a water and sanitary sewer user. They were concerned about coming to Detroit Lakes because of the cost of the wastewater and what it's going to cost to discharge water to our system, and it's a significant cost to their production. We were able to get them to come to town. That's going to bring jobs. It's going to bring business base, tax base to the community. But we're on the threshold of becoming unaffordable. We need to maintain affordable sanitary sewer rates both for the citizens of our community, economic development, business development, and job growth within Detroit Lakes. This is critical nature for the community of Detroit Lakes. We want to maintain competitive rates. We're a town of 9,000 people, 3,200 connections, bearing the burden of a $36 million facility that has regional water quality impact. We're requesting you fund the PFA to the governor's request of $167 million to provide some assistance out there for these mandated compliance agreements and compliance schedules. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, thank you, Mr. Roberts. Questions? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to ask of Detroit Lakes, so that's your project, is one of the more expensive ones. Could you just give us a little bit of a sense of what will be occurring with that project? Is that a treatment plant on the shores of the lake? Just what exactly is that?
Mr. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, all of our treatment goes to a centralized treatment location. And with that reduction in the permitted level, it takes an entirely different technology that we have the capability to do today. So we vetted different technologies, and we took a look at the lowest cost capital, the lowest cost O&M, and the lowest replacement cost in the future, and we have chosen a what's called an MBR facility, a membrane biological reactor. That is one of the two technologies available to treat to a 0.066 limit. It's community-wide. When we did our facility plan, we looked at growth to the year 2025, anticipate population growth, and we're sizing the plant accordingly. So it's going to be a community-wide, centrally located wastewater treatment system.
Thank you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So once you build this very state-of-the-art plant and everything else, have you had conversations with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that they're not going to change the standards on you, that you'll be able to utilize this plant for many, many years to come and still be in compliance, even if perhaps there's federal changes?
Mr. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we have. And that was one of the important functions of the regulatory certainty bill that came through the legislature last year, that if we do bio, P removal, nitrogen removal, and secondary tertiary treatment like we are, they will provide regulatory certainty to us. Now, that is for nutrients. We still have fluoride issues, and we still have some other issues that are coming down the road. We're trying to get as much information from the MPCA early to make the right design decisions today to avoid additional capital costs down the road.
Thank you. Representative Oakham, hope you're done.
Good.
Other questions? Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're building this new wastewater treatment plant, will you be building in excess capacity? You said to 2025, which is less than 10 years. Is there a possibility of building more capacity and then at some point maybe some of your neighbors being able to join a sewer district again?
Mr. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're actually looking at a capacity to serve about a population of 15,000, and that's including annexations we may be taking in, and we're also building tankage large enough to build, to add these cassettes, to add additional capacity down the road without having a huge capital cost. There's a threshold for design criteria on where you can go with tipping over being too costly, but we're right on the edge of that and planning for about a 15,000 population base in the future.
Representative Sock.
I'm not sure that this is even the right venue because we're a wording of money committee, but I'm hearing a common problem here. Rochester is told by the regulatory agencies that we have to get down to 0.01. And I think we all know that if they're getting to 0.06 and having to spend a truckload of money, you can imagine what Rochester's bill is to get to 0.01. So if this is an evolving thing where some system is starting to drive the construction costs on these things, I don't know if there's an economic return on investment question. I'm sure I may not even know who I'm asking that of.
Just to the cloud. Anyone want to answer that? Mr. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one thing I spoke to the governor about is with the technology we're using and the advanced treatment that we're placing in Detroit Lakes. We want to use that as a model for other communities to follow, to show them that these ultra-low limits can be met. We want to use this as the model, and there will be some economies of scale of construction once this technology is in place and it becomes more readily available and the manufacturers ramp up. The cost of this technology will come down as well as the construction cost. You just got to get these beta sites built out the size we are to be a test site and show that you don't have to be afraid of these ultra-low limits, that it can be done and the cost will become down and will become more affordable in the future.
Thank you.
President Frankie? Nope. Okay, that's a good one. Nope. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make a point here is we have some of the lowest water costs in the country. And I think we've had a very, very rich source of water over the past 150 years of our state.
Representative Dean, are you, the whole state you're talking about or Minneapolis or?
As a state, overall, our rates are pretty reasonable compared to other states. And I think that we're entering a time where we're going to begin to look at our water rates in a very different way. And just, you know, as we look at the cost of these projects and who's going to be burdening, you know, all of that cost, I think it's something that, you know, warrants that larger discussion moving forward. I think that right now we have towns that need to have the treatment facilities for the people in the towns. I mean, we're at that point where a lot of this infrastructure is starting to age, where it needs to be addressed. So, I mean, we're at a critical time, and I would commend in many ways the governor for making this a high priority. But we also have to be aware that there's going to be some hard choices about how much of the state resources we're going to put in and how much the local areas and the people are going to have to absorb those costs. So it's just something for all of us to be aware of. I'm a big proponent of clean water. Probably be supporting most of these projects.
Thank you, Representative Dean. I might add, you know, the governor's proposal, $167 million, that, you know, what we passed out of the House last year was just over $140 million, which is still, I think, by far a record in funding. I mean, as Mr. Freeman said earlier, you know, a lot of times it's been 20 or 25, something like that. So a sizable commitment was made by the House as well, and you know, I expect that we will again. Mr. Hansen, or Mr. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, the best method of treatment is prevention. And so the cost, you know, if we put money into prevention, particularly on non-point, the point that Representative Salk raised of you will have the cities and the communities that will have to squeeze the technology to get the reduction, but if they put that water back in the river and the river is dirtier, we're getting dirtier, that's we didn't make much progress. So that's the issue, is what do we do on non-point? Because we tend around here to think if we fund this, we will have solved it. And so we can spend a great deal of effort on infrastructure, but if the non-point continues, both in surface water and in groundwater, at some point we can't drill the new wells because the next aquifer down is contaminated too. So the money that's put in here, there needs to be, we're putting money into non-point voluntary incentives, but we're making a mandatory choice of paying for infrastructure. And that's part of what I'm trying to get at with the earlier conversation. The best method of treatment is to prevent the pollution from occurring.
And that is a good point, Representative Hansen. I will take one more question. That's from Representative Detmer, and then we need to move on to the next item.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I was on this committee a couple years ago. And my question is, how many of these projects came to be when standards changed? You know, with the MPCA changed the standards, the requirements, how many of these projects were added to the list? Is there any way we can tell that? And maybe we would have a shorter list. I don't know. But that's just something that came to my mind.
Representative Detmer, I don't have the answer. I don't know if anyone does. Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair and members, again, Jeff Freeman, Director of the Public Facilities Authority. I don't have the specific answer of how many have been added to the list, but really what you're talking about when you're saying how many projects to meet these more stringent limits, that's that very back page, that list of point source implementation grant eligible projects, which is long and some pretty big dollars, but only a fraction of the two larger lists. So the vast majority, when you talk about $11 billion of infrastructure needs over the next 20 years, the largest share of that is the replacing aging infrastructure, the old pipes in the ground, the aging treatment plants. That is the vast majority of the needs. The additional upgraded treatment plants, it's significant, but it's much less than just the overall need to maintain infrastructure.
Okay, thank you, Representative Detmer. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. And now I'd like to call up here Mr. Scheneker to talk to us about the, from the Department of Transportation, Local Road and Bridge Program overview. Welcome, Mr. Scheneker. Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ted Scheneker. I'm the office director for MnDOT State Aid. I'm here to give you an overview of the local road, local bridge, and also a little touch into the local road wetland replacement programs. Before we jump into those programs, just going to give you a little bit of background on local road and bridge transportation systems here. So as we look at locals across the state of Minnesota, we break them into the counties. There's 87 counties out there. Here's some of the mileage systems for the counties. 148 state aid cities. These are the cities that receive a portion of the highway user tax distribution funding. 704 small cities. And lastly, lumping townships in here. There's about 1,800 townships in the state of Minnesota. As you see in here, if we take their infrastructure system across the whole state, the local system makes up about 92% of the miles of the roads in the state of Minnesota. Strictly miles. We're not talking about ADT, vehicle miles traveled, just infrastructure miles that are out there. Number of bridges, it's about 80%. So local agencies have a significant share of the infrastructure system across the whole state of Minnesota here. So moving into the programs, we'll start with the Local Road Improvement Program, created in 2002. As it's stated here, it's really to improve roadway systems on for local agencies. And there are three accounts within that program that funding can be put into. First, there's the Trunk Highway Corridor account, Route to Regional Significance account, and then the Rural Road Safety account. Since the inception of this project or of this program, the majority of funding has been put into the Routes of Regional Significance account and the Rural Road Safety account. Very little, if any, has been put into that Trunk Highway Corridor account. Purpose of that account is really to provide a match for projects that MnDOT is leading for local agencies for that project. These projects are selected through a competitive process, so as funding is put into the program, a solicitation goes out, local agencies submit their applications for funding, and then those projects are picked by an advisory committee. And that recommendation is then brought to the Commissioner of Transportation. Ultimately, he is the one who approves the projects that are selected through that. These funds are for construction or reconstruction only. It does not include engineering, right-of-way, environmental documentation, anything else. So if a project is not specifically identified within the program and the activities associated with that, it is eligible for only construction. There is also a $750,000 cap on every project, unless, again, that project is specifically identified in the program and a funding amount with it. Here's a little look at the history of the program, going back to 2006. Again, about every other year, funding has been put into that program. If you look at this, the bottom part of each of these bars is the bonding, I'll say, or the cash, because in 2014 there was general fund money put into this program. The middle part, that green there, is what is considered other funding for construction. Other funding consists of state aid funds, federal funds, or local funds that they put towards these projects. And then the top part of each of those is the engineering and construction administration costs as a part of those projects. Numbers at the top of each of these bars is the number of projects that were completed in each of these solicitations. In the last solicitation, there were 52 projects selected for funding. If we look at the list of projects that were submitted, there were 87 that were not selected, seeking over $50 million in bond funds for a total project cost of $150 million. So every solicitation that we've had as this has gone on, we've received more applications, more requests for funding. If we look at the project as a whole, as the projects and the program as a whole, about every dollar of state bond money that has been put into this program has matched about $3 of other funds from local agencies for construction and engineering. Moving on to the local bridge replacement program, this one has been in place quite a bit longer, since 1976. Purpose of this is to reconstruct, rehabilitate, replace local bridges. Just a reminder again, there's about 16,000 local bridges out there. Probably about 10% of those bridges are considered deficient in some way, so whether they're structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. So about 1,600 bridges per year are considered deficient. This is not a competitive process. This is local agencies pass a resolution identifying those bridges within their county, their city, their township that meet the criteria for funding under this program. Pass that resolution and say these are high priority bridges for us to replace. They submit that list to us. We compile it. Right now we have about 1,000 bridges on that list. So that's our master bridge replacement list. And again, similar to the local road improvement program, these funds are for construction dollar or construction costs only. No engineering, no right-of-way. Similarly, here's the history of the program. Because of that cap that is on there of $750,000, you tend to fund more projects. However, what tends to happen is those projects are either smaller in scope or the local agencies pick up a bigger share of those. Similar, again, to the local bridge program, about $1 of bond funds matches about $3 in other local funds. I mentioned the Master Bridge Replacement Priority List, about 1,000 bridges on that list right now. Average cost estimate that they've given to us in that list is about $300,000 for us. Let's just round up, say $400,000 per bridge. Do the math there. It's not a one-for-one. It's not a multiplication factor here because there's other things that go into it. But it's about $585 million to complete every project on that list there. That master list, let's move on. A subset of the master list is what we have in our office, which is called the waiting list. These are projects that have been approved by our office, are currently through the process of being approved. So the design is done by the local agency. We've reviewed it for compliance, for state aid rules, other standards, and it's just waiting for funding right now. Right now, there's 149 projects on that list, seeking $36 million in bond funds for a total project estimated cost of about $76 million. then I'm going to touch on the local road wetland replacement program. This was created in 1996. It's actually administered by the Board of Water and Soil Resources, not through MnDOT. This was established back in 1996 to streamline permitting for both the states and local agencies to address changes that were happening in permitting for wetlands and impacts to wetlands. Historically, this program has been funded by general obligation bonds. With no bonding bill being passed last year, what is happening is this program is running out of money. As of November of last year and continuing this year, the Board of Water and Soil Resources is starting to close bank service areas, which means that the funding that was available for local agencies' projects to mitigate wetland impacts is no longer available to them. So these projects now, these local agencies, are now responsible for finding the funding to address wetland impacts on their projects. This is an unexpected cost that has, I'll say, arisen since late last year. If we put the timeline into when counties and cities are establishing their budgets, the timeline has passed for them to suddenly reallocate funding towards these projects. And so these projects are in a place right now where they either have to delay the project a year or they are cutting other parts of their program in order to fund possibly the wetland impacts for those projects. Right now, we have three bank service areas that are actually closed. This impacts about 50 counties across the state. If you look at that table there, bank service area is pretty close right now to being closed also. That's in the northeast corner of the state up there. And so these are real immediate impacts for projects that we're expecting to go out the door this year. Just as a number here, since the inception of this program, about $36 million has put towards wetland impacts across the state, averaging about $1.8 million per year. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Google.
Thank you. Just a couple questions. You mentioned the $750,000 cap on the on each individual bridge project and things. Is that a hard and firm number, or does that sometimes get bent a little bit?
Mr. Schoenecker. Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a number established by the advisory committee. So it's not established in statutes. It's not anything in rules. It's established by the advisory committee. And the theory behind that is that number was actually increased in this last solicitation. It was originally $500,000. So every solicitation that comes out, that advisory committee reviews that number and looks at it to determine if it's still a reasonable number. Once it's determined that that is the max, that is the cap, unless there is a specific project identified within the program for a certain dollar amount.
Mr. Schoenecker, will you clarify again, was that for just roads or just bridges or both?
Mr. Chair, that was just for the local road improvement program.
Yeah. Representative Bloom.
Mr. Schoenecker, obviously, and I'm sure you're aware of the fact that we have some major bridges, the Kellogg Avenue Bridge and one in Minneapolis, super bridges I refer to them as. Would they have a chance of being included in this program, or would they be separate?
Mr. Schoenecker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they're eligible. So with the criteria that's out there, they are eligible for funding under this program. Typically for those significant types of bridges, we would work closely with, I'll say, Minneapolis and St. Paul with those two and look at the amount of funding that is put into that program. Because right now, from the numbers that I've seen from them, they're asking for about $70 million total for those two bridges from bonding. And so if there's $70 million in the program and it goes to two bridges, that doesn't necessarily benefit the entire state.
Good point. you figured out what I was driving at, I'm sure. One other question. You talked about the administrative costs that the agency draws off of the burden in terms of each project. You showed the bar graph there and everything else. What is that generally reflected as a percent? You tell me a percent of the project cost. Is it 10% or even 15? What is that?
Mr. Schoenecker?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I want to make sure I'm clear here. In the bar charts, that top part of the bar was the engineering and construction administrative costs for the counties and cities. Okay. So it's not a state administrative cost that we take off. It's in order for those counties and cities and townships to deliver the project. Typically, the cost or the percentage for that is about, I'll say, 25%. So 12 to 15% for engineering and roughly around 10% for the construction administration side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, that's what I was looking for, the 10% rough.
Yeah. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to your comment, Mr. Schoenecker, that it does not benefit the rest of the state. I would like to say that lots of times the rest of the state comes into Minneapolis and St. Paul, whether it's to go see a Saints game or a Vikings game or a Twins game, or even to come out for a night on the town or a weekend. I think that we need to be careful on how we choose our words. I would say the money is going directly into Minneapolis and St. Paul, but there's a larger benefit to lots of folks, and I understand that we need to fund those bridges throughout the state that need to be funded, because we can't have any more bridges falling down with people being hurt or dying in them. So thank you. Just a comment.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the wetland service banks you talked about that are empty or soon to be empty, do you have an estimated cost on what the projects that will be delayed this year, and so people get an idea how many people will not be working this summer because of that?
Mr. Schoenecker?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. We don't know exactly what projects may or may not be impacted. I'll just use an example. Just heard earlier today, Otter Tail County, right now they have a project that is a priority project for them, and the cost that they have estimated right now to provide for wetland mitigation for that project is about $200,000. And so we don't know the magnitude of it, because right now I would say counties probably are in a position right now where they're trying to make a decision: do we pay for it, or do we delay, or what do we do? So they're still trying to make decisions on how they approach this.
I'll just comment that I'm confident. Well, shouldn't say that one. I have a belief that, you know, something may be done to mitigate the mitigation problem sooner rather than later. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was the point I was going to encourage, is that this is a big deal, and if there's any way that, you know, this is the challenge I think that Representative Hausman was bringing up earlier in other committees, is there's a lot of demands and consequences for the loss of the bill last year, but this is a big one because it has a variety of ripple effects. So if we're starting to move things, this is one that needs to move because it's a statewide impact that's impacting our transportation system.
I'll just say I did have a conversation earlier today on that topic. Further discussion? Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask you the same question I asked PFA. Just given all of these projects require something from the local government, local roads and bridges, and given your staff time and their obligations, do you have a sense of how much you could actually get done this year? And you talk about 1,000 on the list, but you obviously couldn't do them. I mean, even if miraculously you had all the funding, just literally in terms of what local people have to do and what you have to do.
Mr. Schoenecker?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would be confident in saying that the 149 bridges that are on the waiting list, we could get them out this year. As far as the local road improvement program goes, if there's funding put into that, it takes time to get an advisory committee together, a solicitation out, so we would be looking at a 2018 start for projects for anything put into the local road improvement program.
And then, Mr. Chair, because I'm also on transportation, I had the good fortune to hear the presentation the other day, and there was this handy little handout. I don't know if you were the one presenting. I can't recall.
Yes.
And so this is a really good piece, specifically Local Roads and Bridges Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund, because in your case, you actually have another funding stream. You aren't just dependent on waiting for this because money regularly flows through that budget. So for your local roads and bridges, you've probably got some plan in place. I mean, will any of this fund those 149, for example?
Mr. Schoenecker?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. So any specifically of the roads and bridges that are on the either county state aid system or the municipal state aid system utilize those state aid funds, I'll say, to pay for that other $3 that goes towards those construction costs. So, yes, they're utilized for it. Where that brochure does not get far enough down into is when you start talking about the 704 small cities or necessarily the town road system.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Otherwise, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Any other business? I will just say that next week that we plan right now to meet on Tuesday and Wednesday. Could change, but that's the plan. And the reason I say that is what we would like to do is to consider the governor's bonding plan on Tuesday. But we have to have the language. And they told me yesterday that they were within a couple days it would be done. So we are planning that we will have the language of the governor's bonding bill and then be able to review it on Tuesday. If not, maybe Wednesday, but follow along and we'll see what happens.
And we'll
get Mr.
If you don't have the language on Tuesday, will we meet on Tuesday?
Probably not, but
thank you.
Watch your email. Follow along.
Yeah, last one was 3 minutes.
All right. There is no objection.
Sure, we can trust
as Sergeant Preston said to King, this case is closed.